Hello and welcome to the Libby's podcast. Conversations with authors who've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards, lovingly known as the Nibbies. I'm your host and longtime Nibbies fan, Hannah McInnes. These awards celebrate books and everyone who makes them, honouring the entire creative, collaborative journey of a book, from the author's mind to the reader's hand. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. Chat to some of today's best-loved authors about their books, their writing, what's gone on behind the scenes to get them to where they are, and those lovely moments when they and the books they've created have found their readers.
I'm Kate Moss, and I'm shortlisted for my book, The Ghost Ship.
So set the scene then for us. Who do we meet, and what is the premise of The Ghost Ship?
The Ghost Ship is a pirate novel. Really, at its heart, I've always wanted to write a pirate novel, and it's set between 1610 and 1688, mostly on the high seas around the Canary Islands in the Atlantic Ocean. But the novel also starts in Paris and it goes to Amsterdam, and it ends up in South Africa. And it's the story of women who are living their lives in disguise. It's the story of what it means to be a woman in a man's world and have very little agency, but to take control anyway. And it's also about the importance of telling stories and the way in which voices from the past can speak to the present.
So will you tell us how you discovered the women who were at the centre of this story and why you wanted to put them there?
It is, The Ghost Ship is the third in a series of four novels. The last one, The Map of Bones, comes out in October. But I wanted to write it deliberately as a standalone novel so that people could just start with this one. And it's partly inspired by the fact that the 17th century in Europe is the era of exploration. It's where almost all countries in Europe lift up their eyes from their tiny existences in France and in Holland and in Spain and in Italy and start to look out to the rest of the world. And so it's the era of sea exploration. So I knew I wanted to write a novel set at sea, but if you're writing about women, which I am, my protagonists are heroes, they're female heroes. It was considered bad luck for women to go on ships at all. So if you wanted to be a woman who was at sea, you would have to be a renegade, you'd have to be a pirate. And when I was doing research into this period, I discovered that there were quite a lot of what were called she captains who went to sea, pirate commanders who were women. There's the great Granier O'Malley, who was a generation earlier, who was a contemporary of Elizabeth I. And she ruled the west coast of Ireland. There was the great Moroccan pirate queen, Saïda El Hurra, who operated out of Saleh in Morocco, about the same sort of time. And then very much key to the ghost ship are 18th century pirates who are called Bonny and Reed. And they were in my book. When I was growing up, I had the Lady Bird book about pirates. And there were these two extraordinary women who lived as men and went to sea and fought and died as pirates. And I think for 50 years, I've had these women in the back of my mind. And finally, I got the chance to use them as the inspiration for my Louise Joubert and Gilles Barenton, who are the pirates at the heart of The Ghost Ship.
Can I ask you whether, as much as you enjoy it, and you obviously enjoy it, do you find it a little bit annoying or wish it sometimes wasn't down to you to rescue these extraordinary women from history? Because I hear you describe them and I think I would have loved to have learned about them at school, and we know less about them than we know about all these men.
Well, the thing is, I mean, some of the people listening might have read my book, Warrior Queens and Quiet Revolutionaries, How Women Also Built the World. And that is precisely an answer to your question, which is I wanted to find out and to answer for myself why so many women are missing from history and to ask the question, what is history? Because all of my work, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, is about imagined stories or teasing out known stories that have been forgotten against the backdrop of real history. And my belief is completely that history must be the story of all of us. So it's never about taking gorgeous, wonderful men out of history. It's about adding the women in where they always were. And it's the writing of history that has left women out, not the living of it. because we were always there too. And so, yes, it is frustrating. But at the same time, my experience has been over the last few years in particular, and certainly writing The Ghost Ship, is that people are hungry for these stories and are welcoming of them. And as many male readers as female readers have got in touch after The Ghost Ship, it's been one of those joyous books to have out there, in that people are kind of, I knew nothing about lady pirates, as the Daily Mail would insist on calling them. And people want to know that. So I tend to travel hopefully, and I think that let's just get all these women out there. There are a lot of people writing in this field. There are a lot of women and men trying to put women back into history, because we don't want half the story. If we've only got half the story, then it's not history at all, really.
Do you think it is getting better, that there are a lot more people now, and since you've started doing it so brilliantly, who are trying to write this balance?
I absolutely do. And of course, it's not only women who are left out of history. Many different types of people are left out of history from every corner of the world for all sorts of reasons, because it's always about the power to write and to tell one's own story. And of course, that is why it's essential that women and girls and anybody have the right to write their own stories down. You know, we're seeing the battles over education in some countries in the world, even today in 2024. So, that sense, yes, I think that people understand that it's not that women were not doing things. It's not that women were not famous in their day, but that the writing of history was in the hands of a very narrow band of people. And consequently, a lot of women's achievements were ignored or overlooked or forgotten. But the joy is that through fiction as well as nonfiction, we can put these stories back. And I love the fact that when I was out promoting The Ghost Ship when it came out, a lady came up to me at one of my events, and she bought me because she'd heard me talking about the Lady Bird book about pirates. And she had found an old Lady Bird book about pirates, which I think came out in 1969. And my original copy was long lost, you know, in my parents' house years and years ago. And so I think that everybody is starting to understand, whoever they are, that there are a lot of gaps in our history and that we are all the richer for knowing everything, not just a bit of it.
And it's become actually a really strong theme of this podcast, because we've spoken to other people, many other people, Satnam Sangera and Atinuke, Philippa Gregory, all of you doing brilliant things to write the balances and fill in the gaps of history. And it's obviously a really important theme.
I mean, and apart from anything else, I would say it's the thing that always makes me giggle is when, particularly with The Ghost Ship, you know, where it's female pirates, and people say to me, well, why do we always write about strong women? And I said, have you not met any women? It's the idea that this is an extraordinary thing and an unusual thing. And that is also a very important part of it, because except that there is often with historical fiction an overemphasis on the lives of a very, very small number of people, namely people at court. But every other woman, along with every other man, was working physically and hard every single day of their lives. They were all strong women. You know, there were very few that sat on, you know, velvet cushions and were fed, you know, Turkish delight. So that's also what always makes me laugh. The idea of strong women is, like, women are strong. That's
just it. How did you find them? You must have worked so hard.
Yeah, exactly.
You strong women.
Yeah, that's right.
So The Ghost Ship, you mentioned nonfiction, fiction can do this. You've moved between the two. You were talking about Warrior Queens and Quiet Revolutionaries. How do you choose between the two when telling these stories? And what, I suppose, in this case, can fiction bring that perhaps nonfiction can't?
It always sounds terribly daft, but since we're amongst friends here and publishers and readers and writers and people who write about writers, you will understand it. I'm a great believer that stories tell you what they need, that certain stories come to you and you know that that's a novel, that I knew I wanted to write a pirate story, but I didn't want to write a biography of Bonnie and Reed. I didn't want to write a biography of Saeed al-Hurra. I wanted to write a rip-roaring old-fashioned adventure story set on the high seas against the backdrop of real history. When I was writing Warrior Queens, I knew that I wanted to write the biographies of real women. They're not all there in the book, of course, but 1,000 women are mentioned in the book. And it's a global book, and it's all of time book, if you like, you know, from every corner of the world, because I knew that what I was trying to do there was to say, in every period of history, in every part of the world, whatever the traditions are, there have been women that have done extraordinary things and you may have not have heard of them. And so that was a different kind of impetus for writing of the book. And I was also writing my own family story, having discovered during lockdown that my great-grandmother was a famous novelist and not having known that before, and very well known in her day, but has vanished. I'm very delighted to say that somebody, since I published the book, has now given her a Wikipedia entry, which is lovely. Yes, because you know, that's how it works, you know, because you probably know that fewer than, it's only about 19% of people on Wikipedia are women, biographies of women. So that's a tiny percentage. I know. The listeners can't see your expression, but it's extraordinary. So it's that kind of thing. But for me, with fiction, what I believe fiction can do is that fiction helps people to stand in other people's shoes. Mm. It gives us experiences of being other than ourselves. Mm. It takes us into imaginative parts of the world, if you like, that I'm not trying to put the real life on a ship on the page, except, of course, my research makes it feel like real life. Were there real she captains? Yes, there were, but these are imagined people. And I think also the whole series altogether, the four books, the Joubert Family Chronicles, it's 300 years of history and it's set against the Huguenot diaspora. And essentially it is a refugee story, a story of, you know, two families, one Catholic, one Protestant, over 300 years of history. It's a story of exile, of having to flee for your life in the middle of the night, losing everything you know, your home. Now, these are sadly still issues that face us today. Despite everything that humankind has achieved and learned, we still have these refugee crises. It's tragic and, well, wrong, obviously. Many people wouldn't necessarily want to pick up a book about, a non-fiction book about the refugee crisis with the Huguenot diaspora. But when they fall in love with the characters, when they care about their children, when they care about the guilt and the revenge and the injustice, then many of the things that that matter to us as readers can be amplified through fiction in a safe way. So I think fiction often helps us to deal with the big emotions that we feel as human beings every day of our lives, but in a way that is self-contained and controlled, if you like. And of course, the joy of fiction is the full stop at the end, that there is resolution, that there is justice, that there is a sense of coming to rest after all the drama and the excitement and the adventure that's gone before. So I think that's where fiction scores so highly, that that we can live vicariously in a weird sort of way in the pages of a novel.
Mm. I mean, live vicariously and walk in other people's shoes, as you said. And we've talked of two themes, the sidelining perhaps of women and the unimaginable drama of leaving your home in the middle of the night and having to go to other lands. Two things, as you've said, are so sadly still so very resonant and relevant. Do you think that in reading, it can change things? In your readers reading these stories in the way they do in your novels, does that power some of your mission?
Such a hard question. Yes, of course, yes. But I write to entertain.
Yeah,
I write to engage. I write to be part of a conversation. I still, even, you know, I'm in my 60s now, and I still am so grateful that this is my job, that I sit down here at this desk every day and make stuff up or research stuff and write it down truthfully. And this we call work. I mean, no writer believes that this will be their career. We all write, you know, around everything else we're doing. And it's so I never take that for granted. But what I do hope is, you know, the nicest thing people say to me is, I just couldn't put it down. You know, with The Ghost Ship in particular, people said, oh, but, you know, I read it almost in one sitting. It just kind of, and I felt that when I was writing it, you know, it felt like I was bouncing along the waves and through it went. But then after that, if people say, do you know, I had absolutely no idea that there was this handful of French refugees, Huguenots, who went to South Africa, just in search of a safer and better life. Or I had no idea that at that moment in the 17th century, there were battles between slaver ships and there were Muslim slavers and Christian slavers, and whole villages were being taken for the galleys. I had no idea that there were women who lived disguised lives, lived their lives as men, because at the heart of The Ghost Ship is a queer love story. And so I love that. It's not the primary purpose of fiction for me. The primary purpose of fiction is to lose yourself and to be fall in love with these imaginary friends that will be with you for the duration of the book. But beyond that, we all bring our own selves to reading. And if people, when they shut the book, thought, well, I learned a lot about the 17th century that I didn't know before, not least of all, for example, with the issue of slavery, that there is always this suggestion that everybody thought slavery was fine. But of course, when I was researching into the beginnings of the Dutch East India Company, which is the world's first multinational company, and they were a trading company before they became a people trafficking company, there were many, particularly women, speaking out against slavery right at the beginning. And so it's things like that, because we always think that everybody in the past thought the same as everybody else, even though we look around us and see that we all have very different views. And of course, the past wasn't the past with a capital P. People had as many different views. So challenging that orthodoxy of opinion is something that I think fiction can do very, very well. And I like doing that.
It is so clear that it is something you find great fun. And I think, you know, that's why you get up at some ungodly hour every day and do it. And just when we hear you talking about these adventures on the high seas, you can tell. But listening to you then, it's really interesting. It was a big question, and it's always interests me, the power of art and how much it can change people's opinions in society. But I suppose what you do is, through the fun and the galloping through the pages and the fictional characters that people fall in love with, you bring people to parts of history and parts of the world and other people that they wouldn't otherwise come to in another form. I must move on to the publishing journey. I knew I'd get stuck and want to ask you millions of questions. But obviously, that journey of collaboration with a team is something very familiar to you. Done it many times, but particularly this time, I wonder if anything stood out about that collaborative experience with this novel.
I love working with my agent and with my editors and everybody in the publishing company. I used to be a publisher when I first left university, and obviously with my work with the Women's Prize for more than 30 years now, I spend a lot of time in the company of publishers of all kinds, not just as an author myself. And I think that the collaborative nature, the idea that it takes many people to make a book a success, is just as true now as it ever was. What I found particularly interesting with The Ghost Ship was that because it is the third of four, and each of the books has a particular element attached, so fire for the burning chambers, water for the city of tears, obviously for the ghost ship, air, and for the map of bones, the last one is of course, earth. I had this overarching idea about the whole series, but I did absolutely want The Ghost Ship to be a standalone novel because people could come to it and just want to read a pirate novel in an old-fashioned adventure novel kind of way. And that's what I write, adventure. I think of myself as a writer of adventure fiction rather than historical fiction. So trying to weave in how much you put on the page about the two books that have gone before and how much to withhold, that was a different kind of challenge, because you don't want to insult the readers who read everything, and so many people are wonderful and supportive and do read everything. But equally, if people were coming to the book having not read the other two, what essential bits of information did they need to know? And that was a very complicated business, actually. And it's been just as complicated for The Map of Bones, which is coming later, because then I've got, you know, 250 years to try to condense. How much do I share? So that was the biggest challenge with The Ghost Ship. The other one was that I grew up in Sussex. I live in Sussex. I love walking by the sea. I love the sound of the sea and the smell of the sea. But I do not like being in the sea. And I absolutely do not like being on the sea. So I had to throw myself on the mercies of a friend who was a retired Rear Admiral in the Navy and say, help me to understand ships, because the most offensive thing you can do as a novelist is not bother to do your research into something that people know and love. So I knew that all of my seafaring, all the information about the ship, how a ship works, had to be really spot on. And I read everything, and I know far, far more about knots than I needed to, and ship's bells and all of these things. But then he said to me, my advisor said to me, okay, Kate, now you've done all of the research. All you need to do is close your eyes and listen to the song of the ship. Isn't that amazing? And when he said that, I thought, of course I can do that. Because actually, I've never been in the French Resistance, but I wrote about that in Citadel. I've never been a medieval knight, but I wrote about that in Labyrinth. And it was just a question of realizing it wasn't any different. It was just about getting it right in a different way. So those were the two challenges of The Ghost Ship. And one of the best compliments is when people come up to me and said, oh, I didn't know you sailed. And I say, I don't sail. But yes, I've convinced you that I have.
Your research, you obviously take a great deal of time and effort for the reasons you've said. You don't want to break the spell, do you, by getting something wrong? But how do you decide then when you do such thorough research? Is it very hard to stop and start writing?
Yes, it's great. It's the great displacement activity. No doubt about it. It's like, I just need to discover one more thing about buckles on men's shoes in the 17th century, and then I'll write the novel. So you do have to just pull yourself together and not be indulgent. But in terms of what you put on the page, my rule of thumb is always this, which is, what is the purpose of this piece of information you're sharing? So if it's just to prove to the reader that you've done your research, then it goes. It shouldn't be on the page. If you're putting that particular detail of a buckle on a shoe on the page, it's because the buckle's going to come off and it's going to be a clue. Or those particular shoes are only worn by a particular class of society or a particular religious group, and so on. So everything in terms of the research is about embedding myself in the period and the story. And then knowing, I've learned over the years, that I don't have to prove to my readers that I've done my research. Everything about the way I write the story simply makes that clear. And so trust them to believe in me, if you like. And you cannot do what publishers often call an info drop. You know, the 4 pages of the papal bull coming from Rome, because nobody cares about the papal bull from Rome. You know, it happened. There are consequences. But an ordinary person in an ordinary village would have no idea about it. So that's the way that I work. I do a huge amount of research and then I put it aside and I sit down and start writing. And when I'm writing, I'm a sprinter. Even though my books are long, the first draft is a sprint. I write for 8 or 9 hours a day, 7 days a week until I've got a first draft, because the adrenaline and the movement and the jeopardy is what makes a novel work. And so I need to have all of that information inside myself. Of course, then I go back and double check things and have I got the date right? And is the sword this long? Or did this actually happen on this day or the evening before? Of course, I go back and check. But the writing process has to be an imaginative one rather than an academic one. And that's how I balance writing and research.
And your 8 hours a day starts at, just remind listeners,
may not know. I'm getting a bit long in the tooth, but I mean, I do still start at about 4, 4:30, because I'm very, I think a lot of novelists would say this, that the liminal times of the day and night are our best times. Now, for some people, that is midnight, or, you know, and they write till the early hours. If given half a chance, I'm in bed by 8:30. I'm a very much an early to bed person. And so for me, that waking up time when you are awake, but you are not yet absorbed into the real world, shall we say. You know, the dishwasher has not yet claimed you, or the bins, or any of that kind of thing. So I just find if I start writing very early, I can always keep going. The later I leave it, the less work I'm likely to do. I'm not an afternoon writer, shall we say.
No, that makes such sense when you call them the liminal times. I think there's some science in that, the sort of creative brain and also just the quiet world, as you
say.
The
quiet world, yeah.
The quiet world helps.
And the darkness. You see, I like the darkness of, I mean, obviously it's, you know, as we get closer to summer, that changes. But I love that thing of it just being the monitor in the room, no other noise, no other lights, and then seeing the outline of the trees come back as dawn comes. And then you just keep going. And it's why I write in my pajamas and my dressing gown, because I you know, I mostly just get straight here with a cup of strong black sweet coffee and then just get going.
Other people might not understand that hour of the morning, but I actually do, when I hear you talk about it, I do understand it. There's something sort of smug and magical about it and just quiet in the world. The world doesn't know what you're up to. You are obviously dedicated to meeting your readers and interacting with your readers. And again, with this book, again, you're very familiar with it and touring and events. But I wonder about this, and you've mentioned some interactions, in fact, with the Woman and the Ladybird book, but just some memorable moments of meeting readers discussing this book was very poignant, wasn't it? Because it was meeting in real life after all those years of lockdown.
Yes, and I feel very sorry for my novel, The City of Tears, because it didn't publish when it should have done because it was delayed because of lockdown, and it was delayed into another lockdown, and then the paperback came out in another lockdown. And it meant that it never quite felt real because I never met readers. And for me, a lot of authors don't like this side of things, but I love that side of things. It's why I still tour very extensively. And for The Ghost Ship, I think I did 70 events. And because every event is different. I know. But I do enjoy it. Firstly, I love going out and about in different parts of the country. But also readers ask such different questions and they bring their own selves to it. And, you know, it's very moving when someone comes up and says, well, my family were Huguenot refugees and we fled to this country. And if, you know, those kind of things, you, even if people write you an email, it's not the same as someone coming up after an event and saying, this is my family story. So that for me is what makes it incredibly special. And there, you know, there are some events where there are many people there, and then you do other events in an independent bookshop and they're much smaller, but every one of them feels different and personal. And I do think that, you know, I'm old-fashioned. I still believe that books change the world. I still think that books are the one defense against all of the lunacy and the nonsense that goes on, and that we are connected by the books that we read, and we form a community of readers who all love the same kind of books and all meet together. And so that is an enormous part of my enjoyment of writing and being a writer, is to be out and about with the book. And it's almost as if once I'm out talking about The Ghost Ship, it's like the paint dries. It becomes separate from me. And that letting go is an important part of it. So, you know, I'm looking at my schedule now for the autumn, for the Map of Bones, and thinking, oh, Lord. I mean, it's much nicer being on tour when it's sunny. That's all I can say. That's the key.
And that's actually, you've additionally answered the question earlier, books can change the world. And that is something that you passionately believe and drives you. Just lastly, it's a big Nibby you've been shortlisted for, Book of the Year, Fiction Book of the Year. I just wonder what that means to you.
Well, you see, people might assume, because I've been around a long time, that it would be like, oh, well, you know. But because of the Women's Prize, this is true for everybody who's involved in a prize, I am almost never shortlisted or even longlisted for any prizes at all. So this is not a usual thing for me. I was astounded to be shortlisted for Novel of the Year alongside such great company. But actually, it means a huge amount to me. And I will be very much looking forward to the ceremony on the 13th of May. I will be there to cheer everybody else on. Obviously, it's lovely when you win these things. But actually, just being on a list is very unusual for me. And So it's special. It's not like I'm always going to these award ceremonies. I'm usually at them giving things to other people. So it's made me feel like just an author. And I very rarely ever feel that I'm just an author because of all the other things that I do. I'm mostly, most of my working life is about promoting other people. So I'm just going to be Kate on that day. And I will cheer for whoever wins. I'm on the list with wonderful Harriet and Lucinda Riley, who obviously died. And it's her last book. And I think most of us are hoping that she will win, and her son, who's finished the book for her. But at the same time, we're all published by the same publishers. So we will raise a glass, whoever wins.
Do you know, I very nearly didn't ask you that question because of how you started it, because I thought familiar situation, being shortlisted on a prize. I'm so glad I did. You've moved me to tears, really, with that.
Oh, no.
So lovely.
I never am. Never, not for anything. So I was genuinely thrilled.
Oh, yeah. Well, we are thrilled. And I'll see you on the 13th.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to subscribe to the series to hear more conversations with Nibby's authors. And we'd love it if you'd rate it and leave us a review. Do visit thebookseller.com/British-book-awards to find out more about the industry's biggest celebration of books and all who make them. This podcast was produced by Heavy Entertainment.